too, and this is a plot of the premature cutoffs per test, external to the engine. That's things that, you know, the test stand and the instrumentation and all the instrumentation. So we tried to keep pretty good records on anything that could go wrong of it, and so.
Because the J2 was just as critical. I mean, that was, in fact, that was the translunar engine, so that thing had to work.
Five up on the S2 stage and one on the, and we had the altitude.
S4B.
S4B. We had to be sure we got them up and going, but they had to be sure they got there.
Yeah, yeah.
We get them up and going, but it's their job to get there.
Uh-huh.
Let's see, I don't want anything on this. This is a report when we went back looking for lessons learned in the program. This was a lessons learned kind of document.
That would be interesting information to include, because...
Where do you go from here with it?
Right.
We tried to redo the models. The name of this was a study of methods to accelerate learning during the development of a cycle, during the development cycle, largely in the rocket engine.
So I have not come across that yet.
Yeah, this kind of, it's briefing charts. And you find that same stuff in here. We took in and made simple models out of it to say, how can we get modes out? Modes we experienced on these two engines. How good were the filters? There were several filters we had. One filter was the component test. You know, if it failed in the component test, one problem you had was getting the environments right. So we had about as many false positives. That is, we had about, what I'd say, failures in components that didn't fail in the engine. We call that a false positive. We got a failure, but it was not a failure mode that occurred in the engine.
Okay.
And, but we looked at the better analysis as best we could see it in 1969, and then we looked at ways to improve the components, and we took another slice out of it. And so we were saying that we thought by doing these kind of things, some different ways of approaching the development, we could get the failure modes down from about 100 to about 60 that we'd have to take out. And then that's what this was lesson learned. The SSME started to implement some of this, and I don't know where they did or not, but I was talking about program.
Richard said, we won't ask the stranger to help, but you have to ask the stranger to help now.
Yes.
I've got to get something out of my car, so I'm going to go get the oven and I'm going to put it back in stock at 5 o'clock, and I've got to call and tell them not to.
Do I need to move my car?
No, I just need y'all to get it out. Richard, if you want to get it out.
Well, this is more of a stream of consciousness than anything else. But we originally had fuel lines that went across here, and the bellows, these are flexible joints right here.
Right. Those are
metal bellows.
They're not the high pressure lines. These are these part of the high pressure lines or no?
Yeah.
From the turbo pump?
Yeah. And the fuel line kept cracking. See, that's the, and it was originally gauze, so the engineers came up and put the U in it so it would expand and contract around the U. We didn't have those bellows in there that were internally cracked. So that was an engineering solution to get on with the job. And now how the system worked is their Rocketdyne engineers would look at that. I mean, would come up with something like that. That was their solution to a problem that kept these bellows cracking, and you'd leak fuel. And the Marshall engineers would look at it, do whatever calculations they wanted to do, and then would approve it or disapprove it or negotiate it or something. This skirt had a whole bunch of shingles in it. It was tabs. And it was high temperature material. They were tapped like that. They were welded in. And this is the gas generator that ran. I'd have to go check numbers if I to be sure.
I think I had a number. You mean horsepower or?
No, the gas generator that ran the turbine ran at about 1800 degrees, I think it was. And then this came out. By the time it went through the turbine and expanded, it had cooled. We were dumping it in here, so folks used to look at us funny when we said we were using 1200 degree gases to cool the skirt.
Right. Well, it sure beats 5000 degrees. So.
Yeah. Well, it's not quite that hot after it expanded this far. But the turbine exhausted here went around this, mm-hmm. dumped into this skirt, and then left the gases then made a boundary layer, a 1200 degree boundary layer that flowed down the skirt.
Interior walls of the skirt.
Right, flowed mm-hmm. down that. You can't see it here, but the two inlets, I have another picture of it, I don't know if we've got it. But the two inlets to the pump, you look on it, it's round, and then it comes down, it's got two things on it. That were the baby pants.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, I know what you're saying. When it splits off and goes around?
Well, where the vehicle feed line attached to it.
Oh, I see.
From there, and then if you look at it, it's not split. It looks like it's one thing, it comes in.
Oh, I've seen that. I've seen
that. Except for the top of the engine. Uh-huh. And then the thing that's around that was called the bathtub. It was fastened to the engine, and it's what it was put on there for to attach the flexible seal on the engine so it could gimbal.
Yes.
You wouldn't have gases circulate back up into the boat tail. The whole boat tail on the 1C is sealed across there. Mm-hmm. The gas is recirculating.
Yeah.
You couldn't have to go up in the boat tail and get on all the valves and things like that. So those skirts had to be attached to something. Now, relative to the engineering processes you were interested in, none of this was really defined to begin with because the engine was started earlier. Lead time on the engine is the longest lead time part on the whole vehicle, and the longest part in the engine is the turbo pump.
Okay, turbo.
So if you don't got a pump, you can't get there.
You don't have an engine.
And so you start with a pump. And so this is in a test stand here.
Yeah, right.
But in the vehicle, if you go look at the bottom of the S1C, it's got that flat thermal protection across it.
That's
and
right.
The engine has to move.
Mm-hmm.
And so that bathtub is at the gimbal plane of the engine and the skirts attached around it.
Okay.
But now because there was so much radiant energy from this huge ball of fire on the back, you had to do something with some of the components on the engine because they couldn't take the external heat.
Yes.
In a single engine stand, the heat is mostly...
You know, it wasn't until I came here I finally started seeing pictures of the thermal insulation that goes
right.
that went around the engine.
Now that was another thing that we had to do. We had to come up with insulation to cover all the critical parts on the engine because once you got five of them together, you got a huge radiant ball that was radiating energy back, and that's what that thermal protection was on the bottom of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason the fabric that attached to the bathtub on the top of the engine, the reason that was it had to be thermal material too, because mm-hmm. it had to take the radiant energy. Quite a bit of radiant energy, I don't remember the number now, but it was very high.
I know startup on ignition, prior to liftoff, you see close-ups of the base of the Saturn V, and
you run Saturn already?
I'm heading back.
It's just a fireball around the base of the Saturn V,
yep.
Which means what's around those engines has to be just as bad for several seconds.
Yeah.
Until the exhaust gases build up where it actually gets sucked down in again.
Yeah, it can do that, but even when it gets sucked down, it's like the sun. You've got this radiant energy
yeah.
from the fire radiating.
The deflector, I mean, it's still, you get some,
yeah,
I'm sure you get considerable amount
of fire. You
yeah.
get a reflection. You get a radiation energy out of the flame itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a fireplace, it burns over there and radiates over here. It's the same
right.
kind of thing.
Sure.
I don't know what was the. We had a little bit of fun along the way in terms of bathing pants and bathtubs, and I'm sure we had some others, I don't remember. The skirt was a kind of an innovative thing to cool it with the turbine gases.
Had that been done on the H-1?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It had not. As far as I know, at least by the time I came on the program, kind of the mastermind, if I could use that word, the mastermind behind the F-1 engine was Ted Benham, the Rocketdyne.
Okay.
Now, whether there was an engineer that preceded him or not, I don't know, but he had been on the program well established. He was what we would term today the chief engineer,
mm-hmm.
or the Russians would say the chief designer.
Okay.
He was, now, this engine was quite different from the H-1 engine.
Yes, it was.
This engine used a pressure ladder start sequence.
Yes, I've heard that.
With no spinner. The H-1 used a spinner, a solid propellant spinner, to spin the turbine up to get the pressure going to start the engine.
Mm-hmm.
This had this was pressure ladder, meaning that you used the tank head
mm-hmm.
pressure
right.
to start the turbine to spin it.
Mm-hmm.
And once you started, then the sequence would work. It would sequence itself on up.
Yes.
Open things in sequence and start on up. And that was considered to be quite advantageous because there was a lot less the SPGG, the solid propellant gas generator on the H-1 engine. It takes pyrotechnics to get it started. It's in itself. It's classified as an explosive. And so you got all the safety procedures you have to go through, and it takes time, and so on. This was considered quite an advance to have a pressure ladder sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So not only was it size, was that rewrite of the spec I mentioned a minute ago, is where we went to the 1522K.
Mm-hmm.
And how that happened was kind of an interesting engineering thing. But by then we had tests, and the specification was 1500K plus 20 plus 45K minus 45K. It had to be within 45,000 pounds of each side of 1.5. But we had done some engineering work and had gotten the calibration to where we were running very close. That's 0.5%. Is that what 45K is? 45K. Anyway, whatever percentage, not half percent, something like that. That percentage, we were running very close to nominal.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, well, why don't we just write the specification to say plus 45K minus nothing.
Okay.
And the nominal for that's 1522. Because they were telling us performance was important, we said, well, we can give you another 100,000 pounds on the stage without costing a penny.
Okay.
No cost.
Uh-huh.
Just rewrite the spec. And the engineering data already showed that the engine could meet it. So it wasn't a matter, or at least there was high confidence it could at that point.
Okay.
We hadn't proved it, but there was high confidence because we were going to operate engine.
I'd have to look at where the uprated engine was, which Apollo flight it was first used.
The uprated engine was you would have to check my memory on it, but I'm almost
okay.
Sure 501 used the 1522K.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I never confirmed this, but I heard it from reliable sources, and that is that when we were doing the configuration of the vehicle, the specification for what the vehicle had to haul to the mission profile,
mm-hmm.
we had the translunar orbit and so on.
Mm-hmm.
78,500 pounds. Folks building the spacecraft guaranteed it would never exceed 78,500 pounds. And so they were unhappy with that the fifth engine was put in the vehicle. because it's a waste of time and energy because you're not going to need it. And by the time we got ready to fly, their first capsule, you can go back and check the exact weights, was around 100,000 pounds. So if the...
Yes.
If the old experienced...
Conrad Dannenberg said the same thing.
If the old experienced heads had not... Mm-hmm. Had not said, look, you know, you need to provide about 30% margin. Then that was margin on the ability to deliver, but then as time went along, Jerry Wittgenstein, for example, did a lot of the performance calculations for Dr. Geisler and the people in the aero, called aero ballistics lab, in those days, or aero lab. And then after they had flown a few, they got better calibration on the flight reserves, mm-hmm. propellant utilization, and so on. So they were able then to certify to carry 120,000 pounds, which is how they went over got in. Dr. Miller recognized that he now had excess capacity once they began to refine it. So he said the way we'll use it, that we need to explore more. They'll get a wider range, and that means a vehicle. That vehicle was the schedule that was done on,
yes,
and its performance, and once it got there, is second to none. I mean, it was a fantastic, fantastic job done on that. Not without a lot of arguments, but I don't know whether you ran into it or not, but you can check this out. I'm not involved in it, so this is, you can classify it as interesting hearsay.
Okay.
But the soil mechanics people at Vicksburg, Mississippi, they had two different groups advising them on what the wheels,
yes,
ought to be.
That's right. The soil mechanics studies.
And they had a group at Vicksburg, Mississippi, the Corps of Engineers, who mm-hmm. had a lot of soil mechanics work.
Waterways Experiment Station,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And General Motors, who had a lot of wheel and dirt track.
Santa Barbara.
Yeah. And they argued. They also had a lot of arguments about the drive motors and what kind of drives they were going to put on
mm-hmm.
it. So those finally went with the General Motors soil model, I think, and it proved to be more correct.
Yeah,
it'd been hard to have enough power to do what the Corps of Engineers. But anyway, back to what I'm here for now.
Okay.
Not to reminisce what you want to know. Let's see. If I rattle through the thing from back in my mind. We got, just 5 or 10% glamour work and 90-95% ground work. Meetings and phone calls and reading documents. I don't know if I've been very clear on what the government's role is or not, but I helped answer that question.
Yes, you have.
And like I said, an illustration of what would happen in here on the change in that fuel line.
Mm-hmm.
But the statement of work as to what they were to do was a contract. So the primary vehicle, the program office is the technical arm of the contracts, not in a engineering sense. And there's technical side with contract people here, there's technical and there's contracts.
Mm-hmm.
They do the contracts, the program office does what they call technical evaluation, which includes the engineers, but it's not just the engineers. That includes the schedule, the realism of the schedule, it includes the realism of cost estimates and the distribution to the moon and so on. So we had we did have some programmatic innovations we had to introduce. One was the incentive contracts. That was required by NASA, and that took a lot of time and energy to put the incentives in. They worked very well for us. I don't think others had that good of success with them, but don't mean like a self-serving comment, but we worked very hard to do the engineering and then set the incentives, and a lot of people didn't go through that spend that much time and energy on it. They just kind of say, well, it looks like this would be a good goal to shoot for, but ours had to be technically established. Another major thing in the development program was that when we introduced PERT charts.
PERT?
Yeah.
I've heard it. It stands for?
Performance Evaluation Review Technique, I believe.
Okay.
It came out of the Navy originally, I think, probably a Rickover thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it came with the advent of computers, where you could take the computers and take all the schedule information and line up a pretty complicated schedule and find the critical path.
Okay.
You know what critical path is?
It's the one. Yeah.
It's the events that determine the date for the end. And we had, and that was a major negotiation between the program office and the contractor when we're introducing those. They just wanted to stick with stuff like this with some detail, not this gross of the detail.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted, that's what they've been doing. And we were concerned about the, NASA headquarters said you'll go to PERT charts. And Roggenheim was not happy to do that. They saw it as an unnecessary burden on their processes. We would get PERT charts, you know. They had to be printed out, and they were long things, because by the time you took something as complicated as this, it was, you had a lot of activities. And you know, what it does is set it up so if you've got something here, it tells you what the predecessor event is and what the successor event is. So you set it up in terms of the event and the predecessor, or the activity, as it was called, the predecessor and the successor, and you go all the way through the system, and you get a chain that shows you where the critical paths, and you want to manage by the top two or three critical paths. And my recollection, vague one, but my recollection is it came out of the nuclear submarine program. Now, I'm not saying they invented it, but the reduction of the usage on a complicated program. And so Dr. Miller said he wanted to see it used. And probably, in my mind at least, I don't know where Roggenheim would agree, but in my mind, it was a good move, because it required us to go through a critical point in time, somewhere in this time frame here, in the 65, late 65 time frame, or mid 65, somewhere in that time frame there. It required us to go through and really look at all of the activities and events that we were going to have to do to complete the program. And we did find, by implementing that, we found, at least in my opinion, as a government manager of the development process, we found a number of glitches that we were able to fix before they became problems, a number of mismatches in schedule. So the management, the contractual side, was as vital as the technical side. The inside role of the government was vital to, you know, you go buy a car, you rely on the company's quality. But if they had never built one before, you might take more interest in what they were doing.
That's a good analogy, yes.
So people try to make an album, but you know, automobiles or airplanes, but it's a little bit different.
Well, as the program, the production schedule was online, the oversight, if you will, had to have tapered off somewhat, right? Did you transition to something else?
I left the F1.
And how'd that come about? Did you see that it was wrapping up and you wanted to move on to another program, or what did you do?
Well, as we began to get things under control, that is, that we had the management visibility we felt that we needed, and we had taken care of most of the change orders and so on, DCP. One day, out of the clear blue sky, I was beavering away, and Sonny Maria comes in and says, how would you like to go to school for a year? And he said, we've got a Sloan Fellowship coming up, and if you have an interest, I'd be glad to put you in if you have an interest in it. And I came home and talked to the wife, and said, back to the extent of Sure enough, a couple of minutes later, it came out and said, do you want to go to MIT or do you want to go to Stanford? And I said, well, I don't know. I don't think much of Boston, and what I hear folks have been up there, it's not very family friendly. And Stanford, the graduate school of business at Stanford, they have a student housing for families, so we could live together.
Mm-hmm.
And without a lot of commuting. In other words, I get on the bike from the housing and ride to the class and all that kind of stuff. And so we went to Stanford for a year. When I came back from that, then they used me they put me in charge of program control for the engine office, which was all the engines. But it was then in this operations and flight support.
Oh, okay.
I came back and took all of the engines, not just the F1, and did that from late 69, from late 67, and that's where we had to have the operational flight support for the ongoing flights. The development tapered off, but we still were having to fix things.
Sure.
But I went into the program planning and control, it was called, which was the planning, the fiscal, the data management, and what have you.
Yeah.
And then in 69, I got assigned to headquarters to the headquarters team for the definition of the shuttle.
Okay.
And actually did the original program plans for the shuttle.
You left some material up there in that box. Do you need it in here?
In 69, so I spent part of the spring, summer, and fall working on the shuttle in Washington. Then I came back from that and got into developing working the phase B for the engine, that is the definition phase, where we put out contracts for definition of a space shuttle main engine to Aerojet, Pratt & Whitney, and Rocketdyne. And those ran on into 70, and then I got pulled in to write the RFP, request for proposal, which all three of those companies then bid on the engine, which Rocketdyne won. And then after got that program stood up, went through a protest, Pratt & Whitney protested the award, and that took about 6 months to get the protest done. Got Rocketdyne stood up, and then I got transferred to program planning and control of the shuttle office or something. I got at that point in time in the early 70s, and then I got out of program control, went into mission payload, integrated payload, mission planning, assistant engineering job, and on and on.
Okay. No.
So,
you know what I haven't been able to find, what's hard to find, is any personnel photos, either team photos or individual photos to use in the book, because I want to try to put a face on this too. I've got some, but not a lot.
Harold and Abby?
Of people? No, not really. It was almost all engine.
Well, there's only one picture that I remember, and it ought to be in the book, and that is we had gotten a proposal from Rocketdyne, and Sonny or somebody is standing next to it with a meter stick or a yardstick holding it up beside it, just grinning.
Yeah.
To the side of the proposal we got.
Oh, is that?
But while I was with F1, I headed the development branch, but because of the early phase, I wrote the RFP for the production.
Mm-hmm.
At least the Block 2 production. They had some production going, but the contract was not like when they asked me to work on the production side. We had 178 open change orders that needed to be processed.
And yeah.
So I had to jump on those, and we worked those down, and I wrote the statement of work then for the rest of the production program. We went through the negotiations.
that you need, and the contractor was proposing more spares, and we thought that was an all-day Saturday negotiation to get spares straight out.
Yes.
We cut the spares down, and it turned out we didn't need all we got then.
Well, consequently, that's why you have these F1s around the country out on display somewhere, I guess.
Yeah, some of that, and some of it was because if you look in here, you'll see that we had a production.
Well, they also canceled a number of the Apollo flights. That didn't help matters
any. Yeah, that's where they went. But the spares, we whittled the spares down, and then the engine was more reliable and used less than we thought. So that wouldn't be, we didn't have as many spare engines as spare parts, you know, how many spare turbo pumps do you need in case one of them.
Yeah, okay.
So we tried to keep the contract.